All day. Okay, so let's start again this briefing here at the UN in Geneva. Today is Friday, 8th of November, and I would like to start immediately this press briefing by giving the floor to the colleagues of OHCHR. We have with us Jeremy Lawrence and Ajit Sungai, the head of the UN Human Rights Office for the Occupied Palestinian Territory. Ajit is coming to us from Amman. I don't know, Jeremy, you want to start and then we give the floor to Ajit?
Yes, thanks, Alessandra. This morning, the UN Human Rights Office has published a report detailing the horrific reality that has unfolded for the people of Israel and Gaza since the 7th of October 2023. This report provides a detailed analysis of grave human rights violations over the six-month period from November 2023 to April 2024, and broadly examines the killing of civilians and breaches of international law that in many instances could amount to war crimes. If committed as part of a widespread or systematic attack directed against a civilian population, further to a state or organisational policy, these violations may constitute crimes against humanity. And if committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial or religious group, they may also constitute genocide, the report warns. The report shows how civilians have borne the brunt of the attacks, including through the initial complete siege of Gaza by Israeli forces, as well as the Israeli government's continuing unlawful failures to allow, facilitate, and ensure the entry of humanitarian aid, the destruction of civilian infrastructure, and repeated mass displacement. This conduct by Israeli forces has caused unprecedented levels of killings, death, injury, starvation, illness, and disease. Palestinian armed groups have also conducted hostilities in ways that have likely contributed to harm to civilians. Justice must be served with respect to the grave violations of international law that have been committed. States have an obligation to prevent atrocity crimes, and we urge them to support the work of accountability mechanisms, including the International Criminal Court, in relation to the current conflict, to exercise universal jurisdiction to investigate and try crimes under international law in national courts consistent with international standards, and to comply with extradition requests pertaining to suspects of such crimes to countries where they would receive a fair trial. The High Commissioner calls on member states, consistent with their obligations under international law, to assess arms sales or transfers and provision of military, logistical or financial support to a party to the conflict, with a view to ending such support if this risks serious violations of international law. The trends and patterns of violations and of applicable international law, as clarified by the International Court of Justice, must inform the steps to be taken to end the crisis. Thank you. I'll now like to call on my colleague, Ajit.
Indeed. So you have the floor.
Thank you. Thank you, colleagues. The UN Human Rights Office continues to monitor with grave concern the situation in Gaza. Tragically, the documented patterns of violations contained in this report continue unabated over 1 year after the start of this current escalation, and despite the awareness within the community of states that this horror is unfolding. Our monitoring indicates that the unprecedented level of killing and injury of civilians is a direct consequence of Israel's failure to comply with fundamental principles of international humanitarian law, basic standards necessary to preserve the bare minimum of humanity during times of armed hostilities. The report details concern over repeated mass displacement and forcible transfer of the Palestinian people and attacks on so-called safe zones. It also looks into the killing of medical personnel, humanitarian actors, civilian police, and journalists. Our report also points to the reported use of white phosphorus munitions. Israel's conduct of hostilities has destroyed Gaza's civilian infrastructure, its homes, hospitals, and schools, its electricity, water, and sewage systems. Gaza is now a rubble-strewn landscape. Within this dystopia of destruction and devastation, those alive are left injured, displaced, and starving. Women, men, children do not have access to adequate water, food, or health care. People are left in cramped, unsanitary conditions, ridden with illness and disease. Women are left without access to basic hygiene and health needs. Children are separated from their parents. We have been verifying the personal details of those killed in Gaza by strikes, shelling, and other conduct of hostilities. Of those fatalities, we have so far found close to 70% to be children and women, indicating a systematic violation of the fundamental principles of international humanitarian law, including distinction and proportionality. Given the pattern of strikes throughout Gaza, and the fact that they have not only killed and injured so many people, but also destroyed fundamental social structures and support networks of Palestinians in Gaza, they raise serious concerns that Israeli forces have intentionally attacked the very basic fabric of Palestinian society, had disseminated the cohesion of Palestinian communities within Gaza. The situation in North Gaza is getting worse and worse. The killing of civilians and destruction of civilian infrastructure continues daily, including through Israeli strikes on residential buildings, sheltering internally displaced people, killing whose families crammed together, as well as other unlawful killing by Israeli ground troops. We are seeing attacks on and raids on hospitals, arresting staff, displacing patients, damaging life-saving medical equipment, as seen at Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia. The arbitrary detention of hundreds of Palestinians and allegations of ill-treatment continues. At the same time, Israel continues to prevent humanitarian aid and medical assistance from entering this decimated landscape. Hardly any UN entity has had access for the past month. So, think of the resulting absence of basic essentials necessary to maintain life: food, water, hygiene, shelter, healthcare. This takes an unimaginable, ever greater toll on Palestinian population as each day passes and winter is now approaching. In the midst of this, Israel continues to order the displacement of Palestinians from their homes in the north to go south in the knowledge that nowhere is safe in Gaza. The patterns of violations documented in our report are continuing throughout Gaza as I speak, in Middle Gaza, in Khan Yunis, in Rafah. There are strikes on agricultural land, cultural sites, including mosques, schools now sheltering internally displaced people, hospitals, and homes. Under these circumstances, we must again warn of the risks of atrocity crimes. The trends and patterns of violations and of applicable international law as clarified by the International Court of Justice must inform the steps to be taken to end the current crisis. Every day we stand at crossroads. It is time to take the path that leads us towards justice, equality, and security for both Palestinians and Israelis. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ajit, for this, and Jeremy, for this important briefing. I'll open now the floor to questions, and I'll start with Nina Larson, AFP.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my question. I was wondering if you could say a bit more about the breakdown or the proportions of women and children that you're seeing, and also how you were able to verify these deaths. I know there's a very, very difficult access. If you could explain a little bit how the verification happened. And I was also wondering if you think that the proportions are representative of the entire death toll that's much larger, according to the health ministry. Thank you.
Ajit, you would like to take this?
Sure. Thank you for that question. We follow global methodology of OHCHR in verifying civilian casualties, and that's exactly what we have done in Gaza as well. You're absolutely right. It's not easy. Access is difficult. However, we have different sources, and our procedures require at least three independent sources, and we have managed that. Up until the end of drafting the report, we had about 8,000 plus verified, but as of now, we have about 10,000 fatalities that we've verified, including 4,700 children, that's about 45%, and 2,461 women, that's about 25%. So the overall 70% women and children remains for now, vis-a-vis 10,000 fatalities. It's very hard to say what will happen and if we can extrapolate to 42,000. I think for that, we need to wait and continue to do our verification. So I would say what we have now is for the verified numbers, and that's about 10,000. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy Lange, Radio France Internationale.
The report says that the High Commissioner calls on member states to exercise universal jurisdiction to try crimes under international law. Does it mean that the High Commissioner does not believe that Israel is capable of trying those crimes?
Yes, I can take that one. Listen, it's always incumbent upon the state in the first instance. There is, as mentioned in the report, there are other avenues whereby action can be taken. So whether it be a national court in the first instance, and then you can go to international accountability mechanisms. So that could be the ICC or universal jurisdiction. I think it's important to say that we don't want to necessarily jump the gun on that, because at the moment what we're presenting is a report which provides analysis and information. This is based on what Ajit and his team has been doing. He's got staff on the ground in Gaza, as well as staff operating remotely. They've been working 24/7 to gather information. This information is available. It's public information now. The courts, it's available.
Emma Farge, Reuters.
Hi, good morning. It's just to press a little bit more on Nina's question, if you don't mind. Could you elaborate on which sources you are using? And do the kind of challenges verifying the toll explain why it's only 10,000, only 10,000? I say that just because the Palestinian toll is so much higher. Finally, could you just say a word on the Palestinian toll? Do you still believe that to be the true reflection of the losses in Gaza? Thank you.
Yeah, maybe I'll give the floor to Ajit.
Thank you. The sources. Yes, I mean, our sources are the sources that we have used in past escalations. That includes our partners, NGOs on the ground, the family members of the deceased, neighbors, that's individuals, hospital records, so on and so forth. So, and also our own people on the ground, UN entities. So we have some very reliable partners that we've worked on, and we use them. And what we need is three, and it could be any of the three that I've listed now. The overall numbers of MOH, we have consistently said that the MOH figures compared with ours in the last escalation, several escalations have matched and they've come very close. So we do not have reasons to believe that this time it's very different. The numbers are, of course, massive compared to previous years, so we do need time to catch up and verify. Now, why does it take time? To be very fair and honest, compared to any other place that OHCHR has been verifying, despite the challenges, I think what we have achieved so far, verifying 10,000 is quite high in that sense. Yes, overall figures are massive, and we have only done probably 1/4, but this is the nature of verification. We not only verify the numbers, we verify the circumstances under which they were killed, whether it was a house, a family together, the time, the date, so on and so forth. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ajit. Nina, I've got a long list. You want to? Okay, go ahead. A short follow up, and I'll go
Thanks.
To the platform.
Thank you, Ajit. I was wondering if you could say just on the fact that I understand about 80% of the deaths that you've verified are in residential buildings. Do you think that could possibly skew the proportions? If you could just say something on that, thank you.
Ajit?
Yeah, I mean, I think we would definitely have to wait and see as we move forward. That's exactly why I'm a bit reluctant to say that if we can extrapolate what we have now for 10,000 to 42,000. So I am very careful when we put out verified numbers. So we would come out with more details as we move ahead, but it's entirely possible.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to the platform. I'll start with Christian Ulrich, the German news agency.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm also puzzled about the figures. When I first read this report, I thought the 8,119 referred to the first 6 months, as the report does. Can you clarify that? No, this actually refers to the total until today. Or is it the first 6 months? And I'm also trying to work out whether this is representative of the total number or what your estimates are, what the total number of deaths is that is not verified yet.
Ajit.
Thank you.
Yeah. The total verified numbers are from October to August, but it is not complete. I mean, there are several we are still verifying. It does not mean that we have covered everything. The process is ongoing. So I'll be very careful in saying this is a complete picture. So that's a message that I would want to pass.
Lisa Schlein, Voice of America.
Thank you. Good morning. I'd like to know whether you think what's going on is a genocide or ethnic cleansing, and also have the Israeli authorities seen the report? Have you received any comment from the Israeli authorities regarding the report?
Thank Jeremy. You. Thank you, Lisa. Jeremy.
Yes, I can answer that one, Lisa. So, yes, as per normal practice, we share our reports with the states concerned, the parties concerned. We have not received anything, any feedback from the Israelis on this report. With respect to the issue of genocide, and as you're correct, genocide is mentioned in the report, as are war crimes and crimes against humanity, all of them are particularly egregious crimes and fall under the banner of what we call atrocity crimes. In short, as I said to you before, it would be for a court, whether that, as Jeremy asked, whether it be a local court or an international court or some other international mechanism, to make the determination on whether the necessary intent existed for the international crimes under the genocide conventions or Geneva conventions, for that matter. It's not up to our office to make a determination on whether a crime has been committed. That is for a judicial body such as the ICJ or the ICC.
Lisa, you have a follow-up? Unmute yourself, please.
Yes, go ahead. Yes. It's hard moving the arrow around sometimes. I do a quick follow-up. This concerns the report that I've heard. I don't know if there's any truth to it or not. Perhaps you can enlighten me. And that is that that Israel intends to essentially construct a wall around Gaza. I've got a lot of walls on my mind these days concerning the United States, but in regard to Gaza, have you heard about this? Is there any truth to this, that essentially enclosing the population within walls?
Maybe Ajit, you want to take this one about the wall, a possible wall?
Sure, thank you. I haven't heard that information, but so far at least. But the fact of the matter is that Gaza has been under a blockade for 17 years. So that's already a fact, and that's been that has a major impact on people's rights even before the current escalation. But then we have also seen since the beginning of the war, post 7th of October, there's been massive siege on Gaza, which has impacted massively on the humanitarian aid that's needed for people. Unfortunately, on your specific question on the wall, I do not have further information.
Thank you very much. Satoko Adachi. Sorry, Yumiru Chimbun.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Thank you for doing this. I have a question about what's happening in the northern Gaza right now. Do you think that the so-called general's plan is being carried out in the North Gaza, which is basically depopulation of the North by any means? And if you could give us some insight of this. Thank you.
Thank you, Ajit.
Thanks for that. I mean, what I can say is, I mean, it's a fact that from the since the 6th of October, the UN has struggled to go to the north of Gaza. That is Beit Lahia, Beit Hanun, and Jabalia. At the same time, Israeli Defense Forces have been asking people to move from there to south. Further yesterday, for instance, there were further evacuation orders for people in what we call as the beach camp in Gaza. So there's clear, constant push of the people to move down southwards, like I mentioned in my remarks earlier. At the same time, there's a strangulation of humanitarian aid that's desperately needed for life-saving, whether it's water, food, shelter, et cetera. So with those two combination, there's a clear message to the people in the north of Gaza to move southwards. And that's going to be terrible. And not to mention that there are no guarantees of return back to those places.
Robin Miller, AFP.
Thank you. Question for Jeremy. Just if you have any reaction on the incident in Amsterdam last night, the violence surrounding the football match between Ajax and Maccabi Tel Aviv, which the Dutch Prime Minister has described as completely unacceptable anti-Semitic attacks. Thank you.
Yes, I can take that one. Yes, we've seen these very troubling reports. Nobody should be subjected to discrimination or violence on the basis of their national, religious, ethnic, or other origin. We understand, as you point out, that authorities have launched an investigation into this incident.
Thank you very much. I don't see other questions for you, Ajit and Jeremy. Thank you very, very much for bringing us this important report and for the briefing from the field. And I'd like now to go to our second guest here in the room, Dominique and Olga. Maybe you want to come to the podium? As we know, and then we will go to IFRC and FAO. Welcome. I don't need to introduce you to Dominique Hyde, the UNHCR Director of External Relations. Another crisis, another terrible crisis you want to shed more light on, Dominique. I'll give you the floor.
Thank you, Alessandra, and good morning, everybody. I'm here to speak to you about my recent trip to Eastern Chad. This week, we have reached a devastating milestone. Since the war broke out 19 months ago, over 3 million people have been forced to flee Sudan, seeking safety in neighboring countries and further afield. It's been over a year and a half of unimaginable suffering, brutal atrocities, and widespread human rights violations. Every day of every minute, thousands of lives are shattered by war and violence away from the world's attention. A year ago, I was here briefing you on my trip to the White Nile in Sudan. And today, I want to share with you some of the harrowing stories of unspeakable violence, desperation, and of lives lost by the war that I heard from the refugees I met in Chad, fleeing Sudan. As I said, I visited Eastern Chad last week. Well, actually, yes, I just came back from there. And Chad has become what I would call a sanctuary, a lifeline for these refugees. The 700,000 Sudanese refugees who have fled since the beginning of the war in April of last year. The majority of them are women and children, close to 90%. And they've been forced to flee their home since the brutal and indiscriminate civil war started in Sudan. This is the largest refugee influx in Chad's history, and new arrivals come in addition to the already 400,000 Sudanese who are already living in protracted situations in Chad, bringing the total Sudanese refugee population in Chad to 1.1 million and counting. And the daily outflow is just extraordinary. In the month of October alone, we saw 60,000 refugees cross the border, a huge increase, and that's following the escalation of what's happening in the Darfurs. People are arriving not just in squalid conditions. They're carrying nothing but their memories of unimaginable violence that they've witnessed and survived. Civilians are once again paying the highest price to this violent conflict. Those who managed to escape to Chad recounted to me the atrocities that they have survived. I heard firsthand accounts of the inhumane violence Sudanese refugees have survived. Civilians terrorized, houses looted, people and livestock killed. I spoke to people who watched while their families were murdered. People are targeted on the basis of their ethnicity. Men and boys are killed and their bodies are burned. Women raped while fleeing. People told me over and over again how they remember the bodies they saw abandoned by the road as they were fleeing. It's a dangerous and inhumane route to safety. I'd like to share with you one account. I met a young woman, Aisha, 17 years old. She fled El Janina, her home, after her house was ransacked. She fled with 180 people of her group. As they fled towards Chad, they were all massacred, other than 17. Of the 17 that survived, all of the women were raped. I assume out of the others who passed away, they were also raped. Six of the women who survived the rape committed suicide. One woman gave birth on the side of the road. As she gave birth, she died in labor. Aisha took the baby to safety with the 9 other people who survived. Just to repeat, they were 180 when they left El Janina. There were only 10 that arrived safely in Chad. And this is just one story among so many I could tell you. I just wanted, just for the news, Aisha is not her real name for protection reasons. I gave her that name. I just wanted to let you know that. These are unfortunately not rare. 71% report surviving human rights violations in Sudan while fleeing. The levels of trauma are devastating, with families that are shocked after fleeing the horrors of war, still living in fear, even without an immediate threat. I am appalled by the impunity and the lack of action that is etching permanent scars on millions of lives, causing unbearable suffering and shattering a whole generation. And something I will not be able to get out of my mind is that this horrifying situation that is happening in Darfur is happening without witnesses. Many of the refugees I spoke to or with in Chad shared heartbreaking stories like the one I mentioned, but also of relief of having crossed the border in safety, not hearing bombs at night, and not being scared for their lives. For many, arriving in Chad is really the first time they felt safe in months. And that's why I've been saying that for me, Chad is a sanctuary. Other countries neighboring Sudan, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Egypt, Central African Republic have gone above and beyond their means, not only providing safety for people to flee, but extending a chance to refugees to start rebuilding their lives while in exile, ensuring children can go to school, giving refugees the right to work, in some cases start new businesses, and the chances to contribute to the communities hosting them. This crucial support is helping Sudanese refugees to try to maybe not forget about what happened to them, but at least look ahead. The needs are immense, and neighboring countries are feeling the pressure. Just a few other points, Alessandra. Adre, where I spent a bit over a day, used to be a small border town that hosted 40,000 or has 40,000 people living in it. Now it has over 230,000 refugees in addition. You can imagine what that feels like. We're in Geneva. It's a population of 500,000 about in Geneva. It's as if all of a sudden in Geneva we had 2.8 million refugees arriving in a very short time. This is having, they're living in makeshift shelters. Adre is one of the largest refugee camps right now, and what we're trying to do is relocate the people more inland into settlements with both the host communities, and we have been working under a lot of strain to move quickly, to move and return them to areas where they can really rebuild. So since the start of the war, over 370,000 refugees have been relocated to 6 new built settlements and 10 extensions of pre-existing settlements, all completed in absolutely record time, but tens of thousands of families are still waiting for that opportunity to start over. This is the most basic protection support we can offer, moving people far from the border, from horrors they fled, and provide some basic but dignified support to start rebuilding their lives. But unfortunately, we simply don't have the resources. The resources are not there. Our teams on the ground are overstretched, and when I say our teams, the rest of the UN, the INGOs, the local NGOs, the governments, working day and night to deliver life-saving aid, innovate to make the most with minimum resources available, while at the same time trying to ensure sustainable solutions for the refugee populations and their hosts. So despite efforts, the healthcare system is severely under-resourced, with only one doctor for every 24,000 patients, surpassing the emergency standards of one doctor per 10,000 people. Access to water is also inadequate. Education remains a top priority for families arriving from Sudan, but children have been out of school for nearly 2 years now. 96% of families in Chad have school-aged children. The future of a whole generation is at risk. Family told me of scarce resources of food in Sudan. We've heard about this, of course, and we're seeing numerous numbers of children crossing the border malnourished. And we've seen generous support as well from donors in 23 and 24, and that has saved countless lives and funded the establishment of these 370,000 shelters for 370,000 refugees. But we need more. Right now, the refugee response plan is funded at 29% out of $1.5 billion required by 86 partners. Chad and its people, as I've said, have been more than generous, more than welcoming. I heard over and over again that they felt one with the Sudanese community, but we need that separate. We need support now. Peace is what is mostly needed. We need peace desperately. This is a tragedy that a ceasefire could stop. But as people continue to flee the escalating violence, we urgently need more resources to offer Sudanese refugees the opportunities to restart their lives in safety and dignity. 20 years ago, the world said never again. Yet the same dynamics are unfolding again in front of our eyes. This violence must end. It's time to listen, to act, and to bring justice for these survivors. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dominique, for this appalling report. This is a living nightmare for these people. I'll open the floor to questions in the room or online. I know it's hard to take this massive information and terrible information on two conflicts, but yes, let's start with Maeva.
Thank you very much. So Maeva Shawi for Kyodo News Agency Japan. I just have a question. Like, do you think that the negotiation that took place here in Geneva a few weeks or months ago now, led by the US, like, got any effects, or have you seen some improvements or some changing dynamics among the parties in conflict? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. I think that from what I saw last week in Darfur, for the moment, the violence continues. We're continuing to see the outflow. We encourage the dialogue to continue. And as I said, we're hoping for peace. We are hoping for a ceasefire. But for the time being, we haven't seen the results.
And there is also, of course, the work that Mr. Lamrara is continuing to do with the parties that, of course, as you know, have took place in Geneva, but will also hopefully bring some fruit. I had seen another hand in the room, Morado. I will go to the platform. Nick Cumming-Bruce, The New York Times.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for that. I just want to check, are the kinds of atrocities you're describing, are these largely concentrated in Darfur, or are you describing a situation that is more prevalent around the country? And have you been, in the case that you reported with, did you identify perpetrators? Was it RSF? Was it affiliated militias? Is there some pattern to this violence that you could elaborate on? And secondly, I also just wanted to ask, you know, whether you're seeing any improvement in the cross-border flow of humanitarian assistance. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the very good question. For the people I met, they were mostly fleeing from Darfur, so the atrocities and the stories that I heard were almost, I would say, 100% coming from Darfur. What I do know is that relevant bodies are documenting war crimes accounts, and we at UNHCR are facilitating and sharing the violent stories, brutal stories, refugees and displaced communities telling us. We're facilitating this for the SRSG, for the Prevention of Genocide, OHCHR, Amnesty International. But it is really up to the courts to declare whether what happens to these stories and how this moves forwards. And I think our colleague from OHCHR said something similar as well. So that's what we're doing. But I can, although I didn't hear the accounts, I am sure that similar issues are happening across the country.
And in particular, the special advisor to the SG, to the Secretary General on the Prevention of Genocide, warned that the situation in the whole of Sudan bears all the marks of risk of genocide. Nick, you have a follow-up. See, your hand is still up.
Yeah, I wasn't unmuted, but I am now. Yeah, I was asking also about the cross-border flow of humanitarian assistance. Has there been any improvement at all? If not, why not? Thank you.
So I think our concern right now is whether the border will remain open after the 15 of November. When I was there, I did meet the colleagues who are doing cross-border operations, which continue, but that's our main concern, is what will happen after the 15th of November.
Gotcha. Also expressed this worry. Any other question to Dominique? Turning to Olga. Will you send out the notes, or maybe it's already done?
It should be done, otherwise you will get them soon.
Okay, so you'll have the notes from Dominique. Thank you very, very much for coming and briefing us again on this incredibly awful situation, and good luck with your important work. Thank you. Let's go back to the Middle East. We have online Lotte Rupert, the IFRC head of operations in Lebanon. She's getting to us from Beirut. And I would like to welcome Hannah Copeland from the office from the IFRC office here in Geneva. And we'll hear from Lotte about the emergency appeal for Lebanon that IFRC is launching. Lotte, you have the floor.
Good morning, and greetings from Lebanon. So more than 1 million people throughout Lebanon have now been forced to flee their homes following the severe escalation of violence in September. And recognizing the immense amount of aid that is needed to respond to this situation, and also considering the many challenges that lie ahead in the coming months and the coming years, the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies has launched an emergency appeal this week, asking for a total of 100 million Swiss francs. And this support is desperately needed to be able to address the humanitarian needs in Lebanon, which are still rising day by day. And the situation is particularly concerning given that winter is on its way and that many people are now homeless or living in overcrowded conditions. And the Lebanese Red Cross had already skilled up its response in the past year, but we now find ourselves in a completely new reality where staff and volunteers are responding nonstop to the dramatic needs across the country. And it's important to emphasize that Lebanese Red Cross is responsible for around 80% of all the ambulance services in the country as a key local actor mandated by the Lebanese government. On top of that, teams from the Lebanese Red Cross are delivering essential relief items every day to the vast number of people who've been forced to leave their homes. So we are saying that more funding is critical to ensure that the staff and volunteers can continue carrying out their life-saving work. I would also like to highlight that this week, our Secretary General at the IFRC, Jagan Shapagain, came to Beirut, mainly to express his solidarity with people in Lebanon and to launch this emergency appeal together with the Secretary General of the Lebanese Red Cross. And together we visited an aid distribution at one of the temporary shelters here in Beirut. And it was devastating to witness the trauma of people who've had to leave everything behind, often multiple times. Many people have lost their belongings, their livelihoods, and some of them have even lost their loved ones. And one of the people we spoke with was Ahmad, a 14-year-old boy who fled his house in the middle of the night after his neighborhood in southern Beirut was heavily bombed. And he and his family told us that they've had to move three times before they could reach safety. And he told us that he even had to sleep on the beach during the first few nights. Currently, Ahmed can't go to school anymore because many of them are still closed and are used as temporary shelters, but he's committed to try and study himself. Nevertheless, he's told us that he's really missing his friends and his classmates. And actually, all he wants is to go home, back to a life that he had to leave behind. But right now, the situation is too dangerous in southern Beirut. So the Lebanese Red Cross has provided his family with mattresses, food, and other supplies that they urgently need. And we are also giving them medical support and psychological support. So this support has given his family one less thing to worry about during this incredibly difficult time. Another story I heard this week is from Reem, a Lebanese Red Cross ambulance volunteer from Nabatieh, which is a city not far from the border. Her city and the ambulance center that she volunteered at for years are destroyed. And with tears in her eyes, she shared what being a volunteer means to her. And she and many other brave volunteers will never lay down their Red Cross vests, even though they are sometimes affected or displaced themselves. In fact, 17 of our Lebanese Red Cross volunteers have been injured in the past weeks while they were on duty, and three of them have been injured multiple times. Nevertheless, they keep going and they are risking their own lives to help others in need. And their dedication to the Red Cross and to humanity enables this organization to continue. And this is why I would like to reiterate one very critical message, that civilians and humanitarians must be protected under all circumstances, and our staff and volunteers must be unhindered when they carry out their life-saving work. So let me close by saying that this is a marathon, it's not a sprint. Even if the hostilities in Lebanon were to end in this very moment, which is something we're all deeply hoping for, the needs will still be there. Houses and livelihoods will need to be rebuilt. And this is why international solidarity with Lebanese people is so urgent and critical. We cannot leave them alone. The Lebanese Red Cross, with the support of the I4C, remains committed to provide critical humanitarian assistance under very challenging circumstances. But our response cannot continue without more international support for our new emergency appeal. Thank you for your consideration, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Lotte, for this briefing and for telling us of these appalling stories. Is there any question in the room? Nina Larsson, AFP.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to ask if you, how much money you've received so far towards this appeal, and the impact you think it will have if you're not able to raise more, because there is an issue with lacking support for these appeals at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you, yes. So the IFRC had already launched an appeal last year in October as a result of the escalation of hostilities in Gaza. And Lebanon had received approximately 9.3 million of funds through that appeal. But the situation since September is completely different, and we're now launching this new appeal to really address the severe impact of the hostilities in Lebanon and to also look at the coming 2 years. So for the new appeal, we haven't received any funding to date. We've launched it on Tuesday, and we're very much relying on more international support to be able to continue. At the moment, we're facing a severe funding gap, and a lot of critical services, such as the ambulances and the blood transfusion services, they have had to scale up massively to respond to the growing demand. But on the long term, we're not able to continue that level of support without additional support.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, you mentioned an appeal last year. How much was that for, and what was the percentage covered?
The appeal was for 200 million, which was for the four national societies responding to the effects of the crisis in Gaza, and the appeal was 14% funded.
Clear. Thank you very much. Other questions to the IFRC? I don't see any, so thank you very much, Lotte and Anna, and go ahead. Thank you. Thank you very much, Lotte. Good luck with your work in Lebanon. Hopefully your appeal will be heard. I will now go to the last of our speakers today, who comes to us from Rome. Monica Totova, who is the senior economist of FAO, and she has an update for us on the monthly update for us on the global food commodity prices.
Thank you. Good afternoon, good morning still, good morning from Rome. Thank you very much for the invitation and the opportunity to present here on this briefing. My briefing concerns the FAO food price index that was released this morning. The index increased by 2% in October compared to September, reaching the highest level since April 2023, that is 18 months. Compared to historical levels, however, the food price index in October was 5.5% higher than its corresponding value 1 year ago, but remained over 20% below the peak reached in March 2022. Price quotations for all commodities in the index except meat strengthened. Now, I'll give you a brief overview on the commodity groups in the order of magnitude. The vegetable oil price index increased by 7.3%, reaching a two-year high, as quotations rose for all vegetable oils, driven mainly by concerns about the production levels. For sugar, the sugar price index increased by 2.6% amid persisting concerns over the 24-25 production outlook in Brazil, following a prolonged period of dry weather conditions. Sugar prices are related to the crude oil prices due to the linkages to the biofuels, so the sugar quotation rose also in relation with the high crude oil prices. Moving to dairy, dairy price index rose by 1.9%, and it was over 20% higher than the level 1 year ago. International cheese and butter prices rose, even as quotations for milk powder declined. Going to cereals, cereals increased by 0.9%, led by rising wheat and maize prices. On the wheat side, the higher prices were impacted by unfavorable weather conditions in the major Northern Hemisphere exporters, as well as the introduction of an unofficial price floor in the Russian Federation and rising tensions, continuing tensions in the Black Sea region. World maize prices rose due to a strong domestic demand in Brazil and transportation difficulties linked to lower water rivers in the country, which hinder logistics. Finally, the meat price index dropped marginally by 0.3% from September, led by lower pig meat prices amid rather weaker demand. Moving to conclusions, FAO also released a new cereal and supply demand brief today, which forecasts that the global cereal production in 2024 will decline by around 0.4% from the previous year, but will still be the second largest level on record. The cereal import needs, however, for the 44 low-income food deficit countries are forecast to be about 7% above the five-year average, which with this increase is concentrated in East Africa and Southern Africa. You will recall that I just spoke about the higher prices. Well, if the cereal prices are higher, then the import bills of these countries is going to increase, and the implication for food security are quite clear. I would also like to mention that some 45 countries around the world are assessed to be in need for external assistance of food. The main drivers here are conflicts and insecurity, as we heard in the previous briefings, with the populations in Gaza Strip, Haiti, Mali, and the Sudan facing IPC5 levels of acute food insecurity in 2024. A very last bit of information that the Agriculture Market Information System, the secretariat of which is hosted at FAO, also released its monthly market monitor today, which features, in addition to regular analysis, also a discussion on the devolution of export restrictions on staple crops since 2007. I'll be happy to answer any questions there might be. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Monica, for this update. Let me see if there is any question for you. See Paola Dupraz. Paola? Geneva Solution? Paola?
Yes, good morning. With the COP29 coming up, I was wondering if you can comment on what you've been seeing in terms of climate impacts on food prices over the last few years and food security?
Okay, I'm still on. So in terms of, you know, agriculture by definition, agriculture production has always been prone to extreme weather events, right? In terms of weather events, there is still a large body of research ongoing that is trying to assess whether the higher frequency of the extreme weather events is on to what extent is related. I will not comment on it, but certainly what we are observing is this higher occurrence of extreme weather events. If we look at droughts, if we look at floods, if we look at storms that are present. In terms of the commodities that we have in the food price index, those are very basic commodities that are produced globally. So if you have an extreme weather event that is affecting, for example, a drought in North Africa, which decreases the production, then the production decreases there while it is going to be stable or increase somewhere else. So when we look at the global picture, it is this nature that the commodities are produced on different continents in different countries that kind of mitigates the effect of what happens with the higher occurrence of extreme weather events. Of course, this is different when you then focus on specific region or even specific countries.
Thank you very much. Paula, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I guess what I wanted to know was to what degree has climate change contributed to food inflation? Food price.
That's a pretty long-fetch question, but we can, because you don't have the impact, the food price inflation is related to the prices that the consumers are paying. What we look at here in this particular case are the prices of the commodities, right? So on prices of the commodities, you can have some impact. I am not aware what it is. We have not done this particular research, but this impact eventually, when it goes down the value chain to the price that the consumers are paying for the particular product, there are additional costs that are coming into it, right? So it's not as easy to make the direct link between the climate change or the impact of the climate change and the food prices.
Thank you very much, Monica. Other questions for a few? I don't see any, so thanks very much for this update on the food prices. I have a few announcements for you. The Human Rights Council colleagues asked me to remind you that the 47th session of the Universal Periodic Review Working Group is continuing its work this morning with the review of Brunei Darussalam. The afternoon will see the reports of Norway, Albania, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Cote d'Ivoire, and Portugal that should be adopted. Next week, the UPR will continue starting with Costa Rica, then Equatorial Guinea, that's going to be on Monday, then Ethiopia and Qatar on Tuesday, Nicaragua on Wednesday, and there will be other adoptions on Wednesday and Friday. For more details, of course, Pascal and his team are available. And I also wanted to remind you, I think you have received by now the invitation, but remind you that on the 14th of November, which is this, coming Thursday, at 6:45, we invite you all to the Cinema Empire in Geneva to watch the movie State of Silence. It's a very powerful movie which shows the plea for freedom of expression and freedom of the press, especially by shedding lights on the perilous lives of committed Mexican journalists who face grave risks while reporting on narco trafficking and systemic corruption. The screening will be followed by, as usual, with our session of Cine ONU, will be followed by a discussion with Volker Türk, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Santiago Masal Stern, who is the filmmaker, Diego Luna, I think he's our Oscar-winning actor and also executive producer of the movie, and the Director General of Reporters Without Borders, Thibaut Brutin. And so that will be at Cinerama Ampere in town, and that will be done in partnership with CAGI and with the support of the EU, FIFDH, and the Office of the Human Rights. You also have received a media advisory for the week of the Building Bridges 2024. As you know, Building Bridges meets every year in Geneva. That will be the fifth annual summit and action days. They will meet from the 9th to the 12th of December at the CICG here in Geneva. The event will focus on aligning financial flows with global sustainability goals and accelerating the transition to a more sustainable economic model. This year, the UN Environment Programme Finance Initiative and its 18th Global Roundtable will be joining the Building Bridges Week, so you will have the possibility to follow the two. The reason for which I'm telling you already now is that the media accreditation deadline is the 20th of November. So please accredit now if you wish to participate in this important meeting. And I think I have told you everything I had. Paula, you have a question?
Yeah, regarding the film screening,
yes.
Will there can we reserve spaces? I saw that it's free. Just wondering if there'll be a possibility to reserve ahead of going.
Look, no. The answer, short answer is no. This is an open screening. So I guess we are hearing a lot of people wishing to come. I think it's of particular importance that journalists are able to participate. So let us know, and we will see what we can do. But I can't just reserve seats like that. But we will definitely try and facilitate the participation of accredited journalists and journalists in general, because this is about freedom of the press. I don't have confirmation yet, but there is a possibility that we will have interview opportunities with the two people who are coming, which are, as I said, Santiago Maza, the filmmaker, and Diego Luna. We will confirm this very soon, but if you are interested in interviews, especially, I know with Diego Luna, we have received already some requests, just let us know. And again, a reminder that the Director General of Reporters Without Borders is also making the trip to Geneva for this film. So don't hesitate to let us know if you have a particular interest in talking to any of these people. I don't see other hands up, so thank you very much. Have a nice weekend, and I'll see you on Tuesday. Thank you.